Blog Talk Radio.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue our coverage of the case of human rights attorney Stephen Donziger and Chevron.
If you're looking for an example of the decline of the rule of law, this is it. A real disaster that threatens all of us because of climate change.
Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Bandy Lee discusses Donald Trump's public health threat to humanity.
The American Psychiatric Association prevented psychiatrists like Dr. Lee from blowing the whistle on Trump. They're operating like a government censorship board, but the truth has come out.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Since the inception of Law and Disorder Radio 15 years ago, we have endeavored to chronicle the decline of democracy and the rule of law in our country. A low point has been reached with the prosecution of human rights ex-attorney Stephen Donziger, who goes to trial in January. He is charged with criminal contempt. He will be tried without the benefit of a jury before Loretta Preska in the Southern District of New York. 3 decades ago, Donziger successfully brought a lawsuit against the oil giant Chevron, which had contaminated an area in Ecuador the size of Rhode Island. He won over $9 billion in an Ecuadorian court. Chevron has not paid a penny of this judgment, nor has it cleaned up 1 square inch of the land that it ruined. Lives of thousands and thousands of indigenous Ecuadorians have been wrecked by the cancer-causing pollution. Donziger has been targeted by Chevron, which has spent hundreds of millions of dollars and used over 2,000 lawyers to prevent the pain of the judgment and to victimize Donziger. It attempted to send a message to environmentalists that we will crush you if you try to protect yourself from us. When federal judge Lewis Kaplan, a former tobacco company attorney, found Donziger in contempt of court for refusing to turn over his computer and cell phone to Chevron's attorneys on the grounds that it contained privileged attorney-client information, Kaplan caused Donziger to be disbarred and put under house arrest. Kaplan assigned his friend Judge Preska to try the contempt case against Donziger without a jury. The trial starts in New York in January. In our continuing coverage of attorney Stephen Donziger's Chevron-orchestrated contempt trial, Judge Preska, for the fourth time, has postponed the trial until January 19. Preska was under great public pressure from international trial monitors and 55 Nobel laureates. The decision to postpone represents a victory for Stephen. Before the postponement, Judge Preska had been rushing to trial, knowing Stephen had no attorney to represent him in court. Without lawyers, he could not mount a defense or call witnesses. Preska wanted to hold the trial in a windowless courtroom at the height of the pandemic. At the last minute, however, civil rights attorney Ron Kuby sent a letter to Judge Preska, and the 55 Nobel laureates issued a new statement of support demanding that Chevron and Preska stop their attacks on Ecuadorian communities. Stephen himself wrote a letter to Preska outlining how she was impeding his right to a fair trial, and prominent international trial monitors also issued a statement calling Preska's ruling in this case indefensible. Joining us today to talk about the status of his contempt trial is Stephen Donziger.
Stephen Donziger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
What does this recent postponement mean for Chevron?
Well, the big picture is Chevron is trying to use the civil and criminal justice systems to evade a $10 billion pollution liability to indigenous peoples in Ecuador. And the main way they're doing that is by targeting me. I'm a lawyer who's represented the people who won the case for over 25 years, and Chevron has decided to spend literally $2-3 billion, using 60 law firms, 2,000 lawyers, to target me and others who helped win the case. And one of the things they've done is they orchestrated a criminal contempt case against me by trying to get a U.S. judge to order that I turn over my computer and cell phone to Chevron's lawyers, which I have appealed that order, and the appeal is still pending now. Chevron got the judge to charge me criminally for failing to comply with his order, which would have put the lives of my clients in great risk, as well as violated attorney-client privilege. So I have been awaiting a fair trial now for 16 months while in home detention with an ankle bracelet on a misdemeanor criminal contempt charge that I believe is baseless and is really just a way for Chevron and its allies in the judiciary here in New York to try to lock me up and really discourage human rights lawyering generally, as well as help save Chevron from this large liability it owes to the people of Ecuador. So the postponement is, it's a good thing because they were trying to railroad me into trial without a lawyer. Because of COVID, my lawyers could not get to court. I was demanding a postponement, and they kept trying to, the judge, Loretta Preska, kept trying to say, no, there's no way I'm postponing it. It was an extraordinary effort by the judge, in my view, to really carry out Chevron's retaliation campaign. The fact they had to postpone it was, somewhat of a victory for me and the Ecuadorians in that they couldn't railroad me through a non-jury trial. But it's bittersweet in the sense that I'm still detained in my home now for 16 months, which, by the way, is by far the longest pretrial detention for a lawyer on a criminal contempt charge in U.S. history.
Does Biden's victory have any impact on your case, Steve?
Well, I mean, if we're a rule of law country, it shouldn't. I mean, no matter who is leading the country, the judges should function in the same kind of way. I find it disturbing that my judge is an open leader of the Federalist Society, which is a pro-corporate legal group, for those who don't know, and the Trump administration has used the Federalist Society as a pipeline for all the new federal judges he's appointed during his administration. One of the major donors to the Federalist Society is Chevron. So my judge, was appointed under very suspect circumstances. She was not appointed randomly as required by rules. She was appointed by the charging judge who charged me, and she should recuse herself for the obvious fact that she has a conflict of interest. Does the election of Joe Biden help me? I mean, I don't know, and I don't really sort of think about it that way. I think generally the extent to which the political ambiance of our country can improve, move more toward democracy and the rule of law, after the dark period of the Trump administration, I think that should help me. But there's nothing about Joe Biden that really matters other than that. Hopefully the fact that Donald Trump is not president will send a message to all judges that they must do a better job prosecutors following the rule of law.
Steve, you mentioned Loretta Preska's relationship to the Conservative Federalist Society. We covered the case of Jeremy Hammond, a hacker whose case Preska presided and sentenced him to 10 years in prison. In that case, her husband had been one of the individuals whose emails had been hacked in the main case that got Jeremy before her. What happens when, in your case, you've filed a motion to recuse her? She criticized you, calling it repackaging, I guess, the second time. Is there any recourse at this stage for recusal?
Well, yes. I mean, there's always some recourse. I think as a general matter in the United States, judges rule on their own recusal motions, which is a problem. Like, almost all judges deny recusal motions against themselves. I think Judge Preska should have done the right thing and just recused herself or refused the appointment from the very beginning. The fact she didn't, I think, shows that she is invested, what the purpose of this is, as defined by Chevron and Judge Kaplan, who's the charging judge. So it's disturbing. I mean, we will continue to try to get her recused. I doubt she will do it herself. It will require an order from a higher court, which in New York has shown little inclination to really scrutinize and hold accountability the judges that are doing this to me. But we will continue to try. It's very clear to me and the other lawyers involved, as well as outside observers, including two extraordinary trial monitoring committees that have been set up to monitor my case, that I cannot get a fair trial as long as Judge Preska is presiding and there's no jury.
Steve Dantzscher, what can we learn from this case about the abuse of judicial power?
Well, you know, I went to law school with the idea that I would become a lawyer to help people to fight for human rights. I believe in the rule of law. I believe as a general matter, our federal judiciary, although it's dominated more and more by corporate-oriented judges, I believe the judges at least try to be fair within the framework in which they operate. I think what's different about this case is the two judges, I believe, are abusing their power and are calculating that they will not be held accountable because there's so little accountability in our federal judiciary with lifetime appointments and, you know, overburdened appellate courts and just sort of the general feeling among judges that they protect each other and because they don't want to be attacked either. And I think there's very little recourse for a person like me who's the target of abuse other than to keep talking about it and getting more and more people to look at it and speak out about it, including most recently, 55 Nobel laureates issued a statement on my behalf in relation to this, what's happening, demanding my release and demanding dismissal of the case. But I think it's a dark spot in our system of governance in the United States that there seems to be so little accountability for judges. I mean, Reuters, of all, you know, outlets, just did a story tracking something like 3,000 or 4,000 judicial complaints over the last several years that resulted, I think, in only a handful of disciplinary actions against judges. It's just very, very hard to hold judges accountable. Judges judge judges. So you really don't have an independent place to go to file complaints other than the Congress, which has the power to impeach a federal judge. That's only happened 4 times in the history of our country. It's virtually impossible to get that to happen.
Steve, in early September, dozens of legal organizations globally, representing more than 500,000 attorneys and 200 individual lawyers, submitted a judicial complaint against Judge Kaplan. What happens with that complaint? Is there a higher body that is reviewing that now?
Well, that's a good illustration of what my answer to your last question, which is it's hard to sort of, you know what's going on. It's very opaque. That was a complaint submitted to this. There's a complaint mechanism in the New York federal court at the appellate level in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals for citizens. And, you know, there were 37 bar associations that signed this complaint. Other than an acknowledgement that it was received, there's no indication that anything's happening with it. I mean, it's possible that they're investigating their own. It's possible they appointed a committee of some sort to look into the allegations, which are very serious. I mean, they basically document a 10-year history by Judge Kaplan of abusive targeting of me through various judicial decisions that have resulted in my bankruptcy and my detention for successfully winning a big human rights case. But it's very unclear what the status of the complaint is. By the way, the complaint was filed independent of me. It was filed by a lot of lawyers who looked at this and were very disturbed by what they saw. But again, it's an example of the inability of our federal judiciary to have a system in place to, you know, check this virtually unchecked power of federal judges You know, most federal judges, I believe, again, try to do their jobs conscientiously. But the very small number who don't, when there's nothing in place to check that kind of abuse, we're, you know, we have abuses like what we're witnessing now with me and my Ecuadorian clients.
Should Chevron continue to prevail, keep it in mind they haven't paid a dime and haven't cleaned up a square inch of Ecuador, if they continue to prevail, what would be the consequences for the affected communities in Ecuador? And more generally, let's talk about what would be the consequence of people like us who are so existentially threatened by the prospects of global warming.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think that, first of all, the consequences for the affected communities, the indigenous groups and the other rural communities in this very large part of the Amazon where Chevron operated via Texaco for, you know, three decades in the 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s. And the consequences are just devastating. I mean, there's thousands of people dying of cancer and other oil-related diseases. You can't live there without being exposed multiple times on a daily basis to cancer-causing toxins, either through the air, via gas flaring, or through the soil water people drink. The rivers and streams are largely poisoned because Chevron built these unlined waste pits and to put drilling muds in them that are full of heavy metals and toxic materials, and then they ran pipes out the side of the waste pits into rivers and streams that indigenous groups relied on for their drinking water, their bathing, and their fishing. I mean, you couldn't design a more destructive, harmful system of oil production than that designed by Chevron in Ecuador. And it was designed to do this. This wasn't an accident like what happened with BP in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. This was deliberate pollution to save money when it was perfectly foreseeable that people would die from exposures. I call it a mass industrial poisoning. So if this attempt to, you know, use the U.S. federal judiciary to try to somehow nullify a foreign court judgment, which, by the way, has been affirmed by six different appellate courts in Ecuador and Canada for on the merits or for enforcement purposes, is really inappropriate. And if, can you imagine, for example, if a judge in another country like Ecuador or even a European country, a trial judge like Judge Kaplan, tried to rule in a case that would nullify a significant decision in the United States by our Supreme Court? I mean, that's exactly what Judge Kaplan has tried to do. He's tried to overturn a high court decision in Ecuador from his trial court in Manhattan in a non-jury trial where he wouldn't even look at the evidence in the Ecuador case that supported the judgment. So, you know, it's an outrageous reach by a U.S. federal trial judge. And when he got called out on it and when courts around the world validated the Ecuador judgment over his wishes, he then let Chevron attack me personally, resulting in this unfortunate situation I'm in. I think the larger issue in response to your question is this is a threat to advocacy everywhere. Anyone in the United States and also in other countries that wants to take on corporate abuse in an effective way, either through law or through a campaign, they want them to believe that they will face enormous risk that they might be locked up or they might be sued or they might have to spend money on lawyers and they might not have the money and they might lose all their money. So this is a message by Chevron intended to intimidate all human rights advocates and all corporate accountability, all environmental justice advocates around the world, particularly at a time when our planet is burning and the future of our survival, of our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren is more and more in question. And I think the fossil fuel industry as a whole, Chevron obviously being an important player in that industry, is in structural decline. And I think the anger and the vitriol and the viciousness with which Chevron is pursuing me, I think is partly a reflection of the company's general insecurity about the state of the industry and where this world is heading and their increasing irrelevance to a safe and sustainable future.
Steve, on a positive note, you continue to attract new supporters. Please tell us about a few of them.
Well, you know, I already mentioned there's extraordinarily 55 Nobel laureates just a week or two ago signed a statement on my behalf. And by the way, people can find a lot of these materials on my Twitter feed. If you're on Twitter, it's at S. Donziger, or on our website, which is makechevroncleanup.com. So I have the Nobels, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, which is the largest organization of lawyers in the world affiliated with the United Nations, has issued a statement of support. Lawyers Watch Canada, which is a highly respected human rights organization that protects lawyers from attack, has issued a great report outlining the various international law violations of my treatment by the two federal judges here in New York. And then, you know, bar councils of individual countries like Ireland, France, Spain, Italy have issued statements of support, you know, and then in the United States, you know, I have a support team of lawyers, you know, that honestly extends from coast to coast and includes some very, very prominent names of great trial lawyers like John Kecker and, you know, Marty Garbus, who's a legendary civil rights lawyer, and Rick Friedman, who is a Seattle-based lawyer who's been stood by my side for years as pro bono counsel. Ron Kuby, who used to practice with Bill Kunstler here in New York. A lot of people have stood up and spoken out about what's happened here. What amazes me, though, is, you know, despite all of that support, they just seem to keep motoring on with the same plan, the same strategy, and I'm still in detention. So we'll see how it plays out. I want to emphasize, hope this doesn't come across as demoralizing to anybody, because I want to emphasize that we have won the case. The reason this is happening is because we won, and because the people of Ecuador held Chevron accountable in a way that the world has never seen before. You know, by going to court, litigating for 8 years in Ecuador, Chevron accepted jurisdiction there. There was a judgment against Chevron in the many billions of dollars, which frankly is a low number compared to the magnitude of the damage, but it's still very significant. It was won largely by indigenous peoples against a major oil company with the help of an international legal team, lawyers from different countries, including myself. And that paradigm of how, you know, indigenous communities can use the Western-style court systems to hold accountable the polluters that are destroying their cultures, as is happening in Ecuador, is never really been seen before in the world to this degree. And, you know, it should be celebrated. And it's, people should understand that, you know, it's, this case has been validated by Ecuador's Supreme Court, by Ecuador's Constitutional Court, by Canada's Supreme Court for enforcement purposes, because right now the Ecuadorians are trying to seize Chevron's assets to force compliance with the judgment in other countries. So what's happening here to me is extremely significant, but it's also kind of a sideshow to what's happening on the main stage, which is the Ecuadorians won the case and they're forcing it against Chevron and other countries. Chevron's attacking me here. You know, there's a couple of features to this that are important. You know, one is they think by locking me up, the case will just grind to a halt because I have been involved in various aspects of the litigation. I don't think that's true. There's other lawyers working on this in other countries. And number two, you know, they think, you know, by locking me up, other lawyers won't want to work on it because they'll be scared Chevron will attack them as well. And that hasn't happened either. So, you know, this has been successful. There's obviously a lot more work to do. I'm hopeful that I will personally be able to get through this and move on through my human rights work as I always have. But I also want to emphasize that the larger case, the risk to Chevron from this case, the accountability aspect lives on no matter what happens to me. And it's important that the world understand that. Chevron certainly understands that.
We're speaking with attorney Steven Donziger, or I should say ex-attorney, I should hope. only a temporary ex-attorney. Steve, I wanted to ask you, how are you holding up, and what are the chances of your getting back into the bar?
Well, you know, one of the things Judge Kaplan did is he had me disbarred without a hearing based on his findings in this civil racketeering case Chevron brought without a jury, where Chevron paid a witness $2 million to claim I bribed the Ecuador trial judge. I did not bribe the Ecuador trial judge. It was a complete frame-up that's been rejected by these other appellate courts in Ecuador and Canada. But it's a judicial decision here in the United States that Kaplan and Chevron leveraged to suspend my law license. And they, I finally got a hearing, and I won my hearing. And the hearing officer, who's a respected former federal prosecutor himself, recommended my law license be reinstated immediately. He wrote a 45-page decision. And subsequent to that, a New York State appellate court, in like a one-page conclusory decision, nullified his decision and disbarred me based on completely on Kaplan's false findings based on this paid Chevron witness, which I never had a chance to challenge. So I'm disbarred in New York. I still have my law license in another jurisdiction, although they're trying to do what's called reciprocal discipline, but I don't think it's going to work. And I've appealed this decision to New York's highest state court, the New York Court of Appeals, and I'm hoping they will grant me the right to file a brief, because this is very, very dangerous to all lawyers everywhere. The idea you can be disbarred based on the findings of one judge in a civil case without a jury, without the right to present evidence to challenge that. That's very, very threatening, and I think a violation of constitutional due process of law. So I'm hoping to get my license back in New York and continue my work as soon as possible. But, you know, the abuse of the bar disciplinary process by corporations and by entrenched, you know, interests has a long history in this country and in New York, where lawyers who, you know, challenge the conventional consensus often get targeted for disbarment. There's academic literature on this, and I think that's what's happening to me now, although I hope to be able to overcome it.
You know, Steve, your case would be a great one to have in legal ethics courses in law school. It's just so extraordinary. Remind us, as we're running out of time here, how listeners can follow you again on Twitter and okay. That website you mentioned.
Yeah, sure. And look, I will say this about the legal ethics question. I mean, I've been invited to speak to law schools all over the country the past 12 months. I've spoken at Harvard, invited to speak at Stanford, you know, up in Vancouver, the University of British Columbia, University of Tennessee, and others. And, you know, students and professors are just astounded to hear this story. And it is being thought about to some degree in law schools. It's being taught by Professor Charlie Nesson up at Harvard, the courses, and, you know, people are starting to sort of wake up and see what's really going on here and understand the threat it poses to the rule of law in our country. You know, if people want to help, there's a couple of ways. One is I have a legal defense fund, and if you're in a position to help me, I have massive legal expenses as well as household expenses. I've been pretty much wiped out financially. I have a wife and a 14-year-old son. And I have a website. It's called DonzigerDefense.com. It's one word, Donziger, D-O-N-Z-I-G-E-R, defense.com. And you can learn a lot about the case by going to that website. There's articles. And if you're in a position and feel inclined to do so, please donate. And then separate from that, there's a website called MakeChevronCleanUp.com, which is run by the Frente de Defensa de la Amazonia, which is the plaintiff's community-based group in Ecuador. It's their English language site. And go to that site. You can sign up for the campaign and get our newsletter. And often we'll ask people to take action, like write to Congress or do this or that. So those are the two main websites. And if you really want to follow like daily kinds of stuff, because there's always stuff going on in the case, just get on my Twitter feed. It's at S. Donziger, and you can see all the latest. I tweet two or three times a day. Often I'll tweet the legal documents that are being filed, and you can sort of dig in a little deeper if you follow me on Twitter.
Steve, it's really been an honor to have you on. We'll continue to follow your case, and of course, we will be hoping for the best at your trial.
Well, thank you so much, Heidi. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk to y'all and to talk to your listeners. And I want to thank you and thank everyone listening in advance for any support, and really appreciate the opportunity.
You take it easy, Steve. We'll have you back on when you win this one. Good luck.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Medicine professor and psychiatrist told members of Congress that President Trump is mentally unstable, could be dangerous, and could even be involuntarily committed. Dr. Bandy X. Lee argued in briefings to several members that Trump should undergo a capacity evaluation to assess his fitness for duty. Lee argues that Trump may actually be a dangerous person, one who's shown, quote, a pattern of violent behavior and violent tendencies. On the issue of involuntary commitment to a mental health hospital program, Dr. Lee told The Atlantic magazine that, quote, we can forcibly commit somebody and could be held legally liable if we don't when the signs are obvious. In Trump's case, the pattern of violent behavior includes incendiary tweets, comments about groping women on Access Hollywood, and encouraging violence against protesters at campaign rallies. It also includes his defense of white nationalists. Democrat Jamie Raskin of Maryland, one of a dozen lawmakers who've met with Lee, proposed creating an independent commission to determine presidential capacity. Referring to the 25th Amendment, Raskin said, we simply have to have the courage and sense of responsibility to implement this procedure. Lee has noted that addressing Trump's incapacity is a matter of human survival, and that psychiatrists could be held legally liable for not speaking out. Joining us to discuss Trump's threat to humanity is Bandy X. Lee. She's a forensic psychiatrist, an expert in violence, president of the World Mental Health Coalition, and editor of the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Bandy Lee, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bandy, you've said that we're entering perhaps the most dangerous period of Donald Trump's presidency. Why is that?
Well, I think we have been anticipating that for a while. As the world celebrated the Biden-Harris victory, in fact, mental health professionals were bracing for this period because we know well from what he has said already about how he has insulted others at being losers or suckers. we know that that is something he himself cannot tolerate, because those insults come from his attempt to distance and disown qualities that he cannot stand. And so the loss of an election is an incredible rebuke. He probably was not able even to conceive of his losing, even though deep down he probably assumed he would. That's all the more why he would not be able to tolerate it consciously. And I think that the last 10 or 11 days have shown that he's not dealing with it well.
Why does Trump have so many, 70 million, I think, voted for him, have so many ardent supporters when he surely has no moral compass that's so evident over the last 4 years? Is there a psychological component at work here with his supporters?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's all psychological. I believe it would be hard to understand without taking psychology into consideration. What is rather surprising to me is that we even managed to eke out a victory, given the severe mental symptoms he has shown, and the unmitigated exposure he has been allowed to have with his followers for the last 4 years under the power of the presidency. I mean, that's actually a formula for his severe symptoms to spread to those who are emotionally bonded to him. We don't think of mental symptoms as transmitting or spreading, but they're perhaps even more contagious, because you don't need physical exposure, but only require emotional bonds. And it's almost a setup for his symptoms to spread.
Might I ask a follow-up question, Bandy? What about the material situation? I mean, half the people in the United States are poor or near poor, and isn't that a big factor in rejecting the status quo and thinking that Trump is some kind of maverick that they should support? Isn't there a material aspect to this as well?
Yes, most people will think of that as more in rational terms, but I, being a psychiatrist, I tend to think of all the other psychological dynamics that are happening. In fact, our conscious processes are, according to neuroscientists, only 2% of our mental activities. And so most of what happens is unconscious, meaning irrational and kind of counterproductive in some ways, especially if we're psychologically vulnerable and our mental health has been chipped away at for decades, really. Our state of collective mental health as a nation has been going down. So yes, material deprivation plays a role, but it's more relative poverty that is psychologically injurious than absolute poverty. And the rapid rise in economic inequalities, the present state of vast gaps between the rich and the poor, those are the things that make people vulnerable to acting irrationally and voting against their own interests.
Bandy, your 2017 best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, contains essays from 27 psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals describing the, quote, clear and present danger that Trump's mental health poses to, quote, the nation and individual well-being. Now, I understand you published this a compendium as a public service, donating all royalties to various organizations so there wasn't a conflict of interest. Why do you think Congress didn't act in addressing Trump's unfitness for office?
Well, initially, Congress was very interested. In fact, a number of Congress members reached out to me even before the book, after my April 2017 conference at Yale School of Medicine, speaking about the ethics of speaking up about a president who posed a danger. And eventually, I was invited to meet with over 50 of them over the course of December through January of 2017 and 2018. But what happened was the American Psychiatric Association stepped in and gagged us from being able to speak in the public. So what surprised me in my meetings with Congress members was that they were depending on us, that they told us that if we educated the public about medical matters, then they would be able to act politically. So that was what was surprising to me from and the conclusion we took from those meetings. And so a number of us then actively went into the media, and we were very successful at first. We were able to raise the topic of the president's mental health to the number one topic of national conversation. But that's when the American Psychiatric Association stepped in, acting like an arm of the government. If you understand what the Department of Justice did to obscure the special counsel's report and to make criminal prosecution impossible, you will understand that the American Psychiatric Association did the same thing in terms of mental health, discrediting us, making the news media, enlisting the New York Times. They got the New York Times to denounce us. And then the media stopped asking for us. And so the public actually has been describing it like a switch turning off, that suddenly we disappeared. That was the American Psychiatric Association. It's truly tragic in my view, because all the chaos and the turmoil and even 250,000 deaths could have been avoided if they did not intervene, in my view.
Well, they invoked what's been known as the Goldwater Rule
in
medical ethics. And I wanted you to talk about what the Goldwater Rule is, where it came from, what it does, because in March of 2017, the American Psychiatric Association expanded the rule to restrict not just diagnosis, but any comment on the mental health of a public figure absent a personal examination. What's wrong with this? Where did this all come from?
Well, as the name itself reflects, it comes from Barry Goldwater's presidential campaign. And so from the start, it was a political compromise to put this in the code of ethics. It should never have been entered in the first place, in my view. But because it was based on a political situation and not clinical or scientific or ethical deliberation, it was bound to be abused. It was always inconsistent. And in the books, it says that the rule is there for the promotion of public health. And so if we are trying to improve the community and better public health, we should not speak about a public figure frivolously. That I agree with, but it's never been used that way. It's been used more as a gag rule, and with the Trump presidency, they turned it into a complete gag order where no one could speak about any aspect of the president, and that actually goes against our societal responsibility, our Geneva Declaration, all the core tenets of medical ethics. So you can imagine how alarming that was for us who, from the inside, where we knew what the implications would be. And that was actually the reason why I held the conference at Yale a month later.
And we want to talk about that conference, but I want to ask a very obvious question. In light of COVID, in light of Trump's infamous tweet, "I've got a big nuclear button on my desk," common sense dictates that Trump has had an adverse impact on even global public health with the pandemic response,
right,
or lack thereof. Are you saying that the American Psychiatric Association is bending to politics to the extent that they are blind to what everyone else is seeing in terms of public health risks?
Well, I don't think they were blind about the substance, but because the substance is so terrible and because mental health experts predicted all of this entirely the course of this presidency 4 years ago, already, what they decided was to make it an ethical issue that they would silence all mental health professionals, even though they have no jurisdiction over more than 6% of practicing mental health professionals, that is their membership. The Goldwater Rule is not admissible to state licensing boards because it goes against the First Amendment, and it's a guideline, not an obligation. But the fact that even laypersons know about this very insignificant rule that probably was invalid since 1980, when even diagnosis became outside observation-based, not introspective interview-based, it's truly misinformation, in my view, and we're now seeing the results. The results are truly catastrophic because all this was predicted and preventable.
We're speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee. Bandy, were you under any kind of threat to your profession when you spoke out about this? What kind of pushback did you get?
Well, certainly we expected threats from the president's followers, threats to our lives and safety of our families. That's one of the reasons why the conference that later became so talked about around the world was actually very poorly attended. Only about 24 people came, even though they hundreds of them streamed in, streamed from their homes. They were afraid of attacks by the president's followers or litigation by the president, and they didn't wish to be seen or heard as being a part of this. My reason for holding the conference was so that these many thousands of mental health professionals could come together in unison, and that would be protective in some way. But as you can see, because of the American Psychiatric Association coming out and denouncing us, many then perceived it also as a threat to their profession, their professional status. And rather than more people coming out, more people have joined our organization. We formed an organization to contain all the thousands of voices, but hardly anyone gets aired. Even if they wish to speak up, their voice doesn't get heard because of the APA's intervention with the major media.
This is just astonishing to me. In that emergency conference that was broadcast on C-SPAN, was it discussed about mechanisms that could be put in place to avoid another scenario like this in the future?
Well, that conference was when we realized that as mental health professionals, we were just blocked from all media. I mean, the preposterous situation where mental health is the only field where you cannot hear from experts about. We decided to do an interdisciplinary conference because, well, this was a public health issue. We were never mistaken about the president being our patient. He was never our patient. We always approached this as a public health issue, and so public health approaches are often interdisciplinary. So we invited a whole group of top experts from around the country, from law, political science, economics, history, journalism, social psychology, climate science, and nuclear science, all in one place. So it was unprecedented in its format as well as in topic of how to deal with an unfit president in this dangerous world. And they all described how they thought the president was unfit. Well, joining us as a special guest was Jamie Raskin, Maryland House Representative and constitutional scholar, and he brought up the 25th Amendment, and he said that the 25th Amendment has as an option of either the cabinet or an other body set up by the Congress to decide that the president was not able to fulfill his duties of office and therefore pressure the vice president to invoking Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. And so he gave that a rather long lecture for our speakers. That became very useful for our town hall just this past weekend. We held a town hall on the Constitution and, you know, what's wrong with the Constitution that it cannot protect our basic safety kind of thing, which, because as mental health professionals, it's not within our domain to say how the president is removed, but we can say that the president must be removed for public health and safety. And we were trying to get some answers. So we had Jamie Raskin's lecture, as well as attorney Richard Painter, a former chief White House counsel for the Bush-Cheney administration, and an expert on fitness exams, join us to speak about that.
We just have a few minutes remaining. I want to pose a hypothetical. If I demonstrated to you qualities similar to Donald Trump's, what kind of diagnosis would you give me?
Well, again, diagnosis is, you know, everyone wants a diagnosis, but a diagnosis isn't really what is relevant, because mental illness does not really disqualify anyone. It's more how severe the illness is and what symptoms are disabling them from carrying out their duties. Also, one can be unfit without having any mental illness. So the test that we do for fitness for duty is the mental capacity evaluation, whether or not one can make rational decisions. And we did that evaluation back in April 2019 because Robert Mueller's report was actually the ideal set of abundant, high-quality information to be able to do that evaluation. And because it's a functional test, you don't need a personal interview. You need first-hand reports from close associates and coworkers are the ideal kinds of information you can have. And he actually failed every single criterion for mental capacity. That means he doesn't have the basic building blocks for any job, let alone president.
Oh, dear.
So,
yeah.
Let's assume he's shoehorned out of the White House on January 20th, and he goes on, let's say he forms a media company, and he moves to Florida, and he still commands significant public attention. Are you and your colleagues going to continue to follow him?
As long as he's a threat to public health. Our interest was not politics. It was not the office of the presidency. Our interest was in dealing with a public health crisis. As long as he poses a danger to the public, which he will, as long as he has exposure, his influence is not it's not healthy. It is, in fact, extraordinarily destructive and powerful, because that's what happens with pathology. We need standards in what is allowed in public forums. Pathology should be left out.
Dr. Bandy Lee, you are Law and Disorder's new hero. We really applaud
that's an honor.
Your work. And we're going to be following you. I am going to get your book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which I didn't have time to do before this interview, but I'm really looking forward to reading it. And we want to wish you the best of luck in all your work.
Thank you so much for your interest and for giving us a voice.
Have a great day.
You take it easy, Bandy. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind, but I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you would do until you put under pressure.
Across 110th Street is a hell of a touchdown.
Across 110th Street.
Push you won't let the junkie go free.
Across 110th Street.
For the sign that gets a tick on the street.
Across 110th Street.
You can find it all. I don't mean to bother you, but I got one more thing I want to say. Hey, brother, there's a better way out. Snorting that coke, shooting that dope, man, you're copping out. Take my advice, it's either live or die. You gotta be strong, brother, if you want to survive. You see, the family on the upper side of town will catch hell if I get over and around. Every city, you find the same thing going down. Harlem is the capital of any ghetto town.
Across 110th Street.
Just to try to get your woman that week.
Across 110th Street.
But you won't let a junkie go free.
Oh, across 110th Street. Across 110th Street,
you can find it all in the street. Yes, you can. Yeah, 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 yeah. Do it again, just like a fish hooked on a line. Man's got his way, reeling you in a little at a time. Uh-oh.